All right. I realize we've had a bit of a hiatus here on Inside the Black Box. Pete's been playing a lot of reruns because he's been busy teaching over the summer. However, we are back, and the title of today's program is The Science and Technology of Storms. And specifically, we'll be talking with Paul Cervatka about storm chasing. And Paul, I mentioned this when we were talking before the program. Do people think storm chasing is cool when you walk in and say, well, what do you do? I'm a storm chaser.
Yeah, they think storm chasers are cool until they meet some of the real scientists who do it. Then it's not so cool.
Okay, so
TV does a lot to make it a lot cooler than we actually are.
So what you're saying is you spend more time analyzing data, educating people about that data, rather than wearing like a cool hat and getting your pickup truck knocked off the road.
Or the black vans, stuff like that. Now, the storms themselves, they're the main attraction. So, I guess it's pretty powerful when you can bring a person to a storm and let them see a tornado. Cool. Then they think that's pretty awesome.
All right, no black vans, ladies and gentlemen, but plenty of cool stuff. Next up, oh, and there's my alarm going off. Next up on Inside the Black Box, science only funnier.
The following is a public service announcement brought to you by the staff of WREK Atlanta. Are you interested in the arts? Wonder Root is an Atlanta-based nonprofit arts organization committed to uniting artists and community to inspire positive social change. For information about programs, membership, and more, visit www.wonderroot.org.
Tune in every Friday from 8 to midnight on WREK for Stonehenge. Listen to real classic rock that you don't hear anywhere else on the radio. Stonehenge has brought you the best in classic rock for 35 years. We start off every Stonehenge show with a classic rock album played in its entirety. Stonehenge. There's nothing else like it anywhere. Stonehenge on WREK Atlanta.
The opinions expressed on Inside the Black Box do not reflect those of WREK Radio or the Georgia Institute of Technology. All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Inside the Black Box, a weekly program on science and technology, or as we like to think of it, science, only funnier. I'm Pete Ledovitz, and joining me today for the Science and Technology of Storms is Paul Cervatka, Professor of Meteorology in the Department of Natural Sciences at the College of DuPage in DuPage County, Illinois, Director of the Next Generation Storm Lab, or Next Lab, is that what you call it? Oh, did I lose Paul? Trent's out of the room. Paul, are you there? Did we lose our guest, Trent? Trent's checking. I have no one on the line, Trent.
You have no one on the line.
All right.
Well, oh, wait. There we go. Oh, he's gone.
There we go. We lost him. All right. Trent tries to get him back.
Yeah. You just ramble.
I'm going to ramble, which is what I do best. So now, Paul Cervatka has taught at College of DuPage meteorology and various courses associated with that for over 20 years. For over 20 years, the NEXT Lab has been used by thousands of people across the nation and the world with the one goal of providing high-quality data with the purpose of helping people understand and forecast the weather. Now, what's more interesting is he also teaches courses in storm chasing. So he actually leads courses in this for advanced spotter techniques so people can be trained in the Midwest and Illinois and around the country. But also he takes undergraduates out to do this very thing. And I believe he typically takes about 70 students out to the world's largest laboratory. That is, various states across the nation to observe storms firsthand. And as soon as Trent gets him back, my first question
is we're going to take a quick break.
All right, we're going to take
and
a quick
then
break.
Then I'll fix it. We'll be back.
Paul Cervatka back here on Inside the Black Box, science only funnier.
catch a slice of Atlanta radio history, repackaged and re-aired for your convenience every Tuesday at 7 p.m. right here on 91.1 FM WREK Atlanta. The Underground Recordings features historical rec footage from as far back as the late 1960s, as well as complete live at rec studio performances, which have been preserved from the mid-1980s on. And you can relive those seminal recordings, like this one from William Carlos Williams, recorded November 12, 1996, all courtesy of the Underground Recordings. That's the Underground Recordings, every Tuesday night at 7 p.m., right here on 91.1 FM, WREK Atlanta.
All right, welcome back to Inside the Black Box here on WREK Atlanta, and we're back with our guest, Paul Cervatka, professor of meteorology in the Department of Natural Sciences at the College of DuPage. And in the introduction, after we cut Paul off, I was talking about the program at College of DuPage and the Next Generation Weather Lab, Next Lab. So, Paul, you've been doing this for over 20 years.
Yeah, we started back in the late 80s when we really had no idea what we were doing, and the data that we got in the vans was pretty funny. We did this before cell phones. We were just kind of out there trying to figure out where storms would be. So a lot has changed in 20-some years.
Okay, so basically what you're admitting is when you first set it out, you had no idea what you were doing. This is... Go ahead.
Right. Yeah, I would definitely say we had no idea. It's amazing how much has changed in the 20 years.
Oh, okay.
It's been a fun change. I liked some of the old days, because the old days you pretty much did a forecast and you went out there and you hoped you were right and you had no idea if you missed storms. Now on the internet you get everyone else and their brother out there chasing, and you know what storms you may have missed, and it's a little bit more depressing. But yeah.
So what you're saying is, given the internet, not only is it just cool to go find storms, chase storms, look at storms, it actually provides valuable data for people that are actually trying to understand and forecast the weather now.
Oh, yeah, we're a whole lot better at understanding what's going on with the weather, both technology in terms of like radar, mm-hmm. and our understanding of storm structure has really been improved since I've started chasing.
Wow.
It's brought a lot more people out chasing, mm-hmm. who probably couldn't do it on their own, so they rely on a lot more other people's guidance to tell them where to go.
Oh, cool.
So it's a little bit easier than it used to be.
But your comment at first, I think, is kind of interesting, because this is something a lot of people don't realize about both science and applied science, my field, engineering, that when you start out looking at a phenomenon, you often don't understand exactly what's going on. You learn, you collect more data, you figure out better ways to do this, and then the field emerges from it. And a lot of people see that as a bad thing, right, in other fields. But in science, that's kind of the way it works.
Completely agree. The amount of complexity that goes on with storms is just phenomenal. There's still times, 23 years of chasing, I still am not sure what nature's actually doing it.
Right.
I mean, we're such a limited observer of this big process in a fluid.
Right, exactly. And from a fluid mechanical standpoint, it is probably the single most complicated system we could ever deal with. And that is a perfect segue to today's, have you got the thing here?
No, I'm pretty worthless today.
Trent just got back on a red-eye flight from Vegas, ladies and gentlemen.
All right, but it is that time of the show where it's...
in the news.
There's Science in the News segue.
Still
and it was a perfect segue, right? Because actually today's Science in the News starts with an op-ed piece from the New York Times this week, July 28th, from Richard Muller, the Berkeley professor, who was very much a climate change skeptic for many, many years, and with good reason, actually. If you look at a lot of the data, it's very, very hard to interpret. Some of it isn't interpreted correctly. Some of it was just plain wrong, and it's because of what Paul just said. Weather is the single most complicated phenomenon we can deal with. The system is just huge. And he recently posted in an op-ed piece in the New York Times. Call me a converted skeptic is how the article begins. 3 years ago, I identified problems in previous climate studies that in my mind threw doubt on the very existence of global warming. So he did what any good scientist would do. He went out, he observed, he analyzed the data. He used approximately five times as much data as the previous studies had done and went back an extra 100 years approximately, and now believes that there's a tremendous statistical correlation between the CO2 sort of hockey stick graph that Al Gore was always excited about and global warming. And that's if you normalize for Earth phenomena, that would be volcanoes, things like that. It does not appear to be changed by solar flare activity. And there are still plenty of things to be added. For example, he's in the process of adding ocean effects as well. But in general, he now believes that the most likely cause of this thing is actually greenhouse gases like CO2. And he specifically says CO2, not methane. So to our listeners, my advice is to go to www.berkeleyearth.org. You can actually look at the last four papers he's written, but he's got a great two-page summary for the press that I think any reasonably educated person ought to be able to look at and understand. And the nice thing he did do is he avoided these nasty solution of, you know, millions of coupled multivariable partial differential equations in a supercomputer and actually looked at statistical correlation. So it's a relatively simple sort of thing. Does not prove definitively causality. The fact that the two track together is really good. Then the next requirement you would have is, what's the mechanism for it? Well, we actually have a proposed mechanism for how CO2 works. But the definitive experiment is, you know, what happens if we change CO2? It's real easy to do in the lab, but it's really hard to do with society. So a very interesting development there. And the take-home message, I think, is two. One, weather is really, really complicated. And two, science is always changing, right? I mean, it'll get away from you. This is not the kind of thing where you're going to read a book from 100 years ago and say, well, that's it. The science is fixed. It's closed. It's hardly ever fixed or closed. So you may want to check out that Berkeley site and realize that, you know, skeptics can change their minds and there are plenty of people that can go back the other way. So Paul, do you guys deal with global warming in the meteorology
program? Yeah, we do teach that, and you know, we try to stay away from some of the extremes on both sides.
Yeah, I agree.
It's such a highly charged political.
Yeah.
Meteorologists tend to be really humbled by the weather just because we know how ridiculously sensitive to small changes things can be, and we're in our infancy of this science. The science is really young. Think about 60 years ago, we didn't have upper air sites and didn't know what was going on in the upper air atmosphere. So we're just trying to piece together how things work and what are some of the larger scale patterns and waves that change in the long term.
Yeah. I rarely have I heard someone talk about meteorology and related areas being in its infancy, but I couldn't agree more. I think that's absolutely true. And even though in my research, I solve lots of coupled differential equations, you know, that might only be, I don't know, tens of thousands. You know, I read sometimes what NOAA does with these models, and anytime you have a model with that many differential equations, you know, it's a useful thing to study, it's a very useful tool, but you tweak one parameter and the whole thing changes, and I think there are so many parameters in these models we don't know.
Right, and I think the best thing about the science is if you're a pure scientist, you stop jumping to conclusions.
Yeah.
If we can divorce the political side from the pure science, we're going to get better science.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that'll lead us to better understanding of what's really happening.
Right. So, and is that something you try to instill in your students?
Yeah, I try to show them that my students come in there thinking it's a simple process, and if I've done my job right, by the end of the semester, they realize how incredibly complex it is and how little they know to make intelligent conversation. There's just some basic ideas that we try to instill about how weather and climate work, and then let them listen to the news and see how those things are being played out in the media.
Okay, cool. So I hate to bring you back to your days at the University of Illinois when we were students there together, and I'll never forget, we were on campus one day, and so you were talking to me about meteorology and your interest in this sort of thing. when we were students there. And I said, well, what do you want to do with that? And as I recall, and you correct me if I'm wrong, you mentioned TV weatherman type thing.
Oh, yeah.
So, TV weatherman, where probably your biggest problem is, getting dizzy when you got to turn backwards and point to the green screen. And I've done that. I have fallen over doing the green screen thing. So how did you change from TV weatherman to being this radical upstart who takes, college students out to chase storms?
Well, it's hilarious. You being a former trumpet player, I don't know if you still play, but
I do still play.
Together.
And Paul and I played in both junior high and high school. In the Glen Ellyn area, yeah.
And I was going to go to music, but I didn't want to teach. So okay. I also loved weather, and I thought I'd do the weather on TV.
Yeah.
And I went to University of Illinois because that was my first choice, and they didn't have a meteorology program per se. So mm-hmm. I ended up getting a math degree.
Okay.
And then I went to grad school, and then after I came back from grad school, I was still going to pursue some music, but there was a teaching opportunity at the college.
Okay.
And I said, let me do that. That'll keep my feet tied to the science for a little bit.
Oh, okay, cool.
And it just, one thing led to another, and I realized teaching really was more than just a passion. It was really a calling for me.
So. Oh, wow, that's great. But you're still involved in music, right? Because you were in an a cappella group in Illinois. What was it? The other guys?
Yeah,
exactly. I remember seeing
that. Way before a cappella was really cool like it is now.
Yeah, Georgia Tech has one as well. So I think everybody does. So,
music, I still do music, but meteorology, anything, type of field that starts with an M, I'm big into.
Okay, that's good to know. Math, music, meteorology, music.
Eating meat, I'm pretty good at too.
Eating meat, okay. He's a carnivore.
A lot of steakhouses on the plains.
The M theory. Okay, that's good. Now here's my question, though. Meteorology, right? It's much like my field, chemical engineering. It's not a conversation starter at parties, not the kind of thing people go, oh, really? That's fascinating. How do you get your students engaged in talking about meteorology?
That's a great question. I think what I try to do from the very beginning is I just try to, what's the great thing about science is it's curiosity driven.
Mm-hmm.
So if I can pique their interest by getting their brains to think a little bit more, not just mm-hmm. giving them facts, but having them question, okay, here's something that goes on. Have you ever noticed this? Now explain why.
Mm-hmm.
And we do, at the very beginning of our class, we do 2 weeks in kinetic theory of how molecules work and how pressure and temperature and density are all related, and they see things, and there's questions, and we challenge the paradigm of things that they thought they knew, like warm air rises. Well, what does that mean exactly?
Yeah. Wow.
So, and once their brain is kind of turned on, I think that the rest of the science follows. And then weather is just a great tool because they go, I have experience with that event.
Right.
I know what you're talking about.
Right. We often try to use metaphors for analysis we're going to do in chemical engineering, and I've had them do statistical analysis on everything from gummy bears to movie ticket box office receipts and things like that because they can relate to that. So that's really amazing. All right, so let's do this. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, let's talk about what you teach there in the realm of storm chasing. And how
okay.
you can actually take undergraduates out on the road without an obscene liability insurance policy. And let me remind some of our listeners that we are live. And if you're listening to us live here Wednesdays, noon to one, and have a question or comment about storms chasing, or the fascinating M theory, right, meteorology, for Paul Cervenka on the program, by all means, give us a call here at the studio at 404-894-2468. Once again, that number, 404-894-2468. We'll be right back with Inside the Black Box. Science, only funnier.
This is WREK Atlanta, 91.1 FM, Georgia Tech Student Radio, bringing you the best in music from around the world since 1968.
Don't adjust your radio, folks. This is Simply Kosher Noise. Oy vey, these promos never get good signal this far from the Holy Land, so tune into Kosher Noise with your host, DJ Meltz.
Yala,
Feel that Hebrew groove all the way from the tips of your payos down to the soles of your tevas. Tune in to Kosher Noise Monday nights from 7 to 8 p.m. with your host, DJ Meltz.
Whether you like your surf music fast or slow, you can hear it all on The Longboard Show, Tuesdays at 9 p.m. here on WREK Atlanta.
Welcome back to Inside the Black Box, where we're talking with Paul Cervatka, professor of meteorology at the College of DuPage, and Storm Chaser Dude. Is there like a title? Do you get an official patch that goes on your jacket or something?
We just call ourselves Storm Chasers.
Storm Chasers.
As long as TV has that, everybody knows what we do. Stupid things, driving too close, getting hurt, that kind of stuff.
Okay, so let's talk about storm chasing. I mean, what is it? How does it work? How do you do this? And heaven forbid, how do you do this with students?
Well, the purpose of what we do is we're trying to teach basic structure of thunderstorms and how to forecast thunderstorms and look at the hazards and how does it affect the community. So a typical day is get up and do an analysis. I mean, we pull out colored pencils and print out maps and do an analysis ourselves. We're not relying on other people to tell us where to go. We want to know ourselves. We want to know how the storms are going to behave later on in the day. And then it's driving. And really, this is where storm chasing reality is not like storm chasing TV. There's a lot of driving involved. So we have to do lots of weird stuff to kill time within a vehicle. Usually it's singing and playing stupid games and being just imbecile-like. And then when we start looking at stuff, when there's data close to the time of the event, that's when we start analyzing that. And then we add the sky and we add radar to it. And we try to position ourselves to get close to the storm. Mm-hmm. And then, if all goes right, we try to figure out, okay, is this storm likely going to become what we call a supercell?
So what is a supercell?
A supercell is a big thunderstorm cloud. You know, those beautiful towering mushroom explosion clouds. But within them, there's rotation. And anytime you get fluid rotating, you have a faster motion. And when you have that faster motion, you're going to get hail and start bringing damaging winds. And if the conditions at low levels are just right, tornado threat starts to increase as well. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're looking for. Supercell thunderstorms have great structure. They're beautiful and amazing to look at. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the tornado is just exciting. And we try to get close by and set up for good pictures.
So how do you characterize rotation? I mean, because immediately I'm looking at either some curl or vorticity integral in a bunch of equations or something like that. And as a math person, you're thinking, yeah. But how do you measure that?
Well, the funny thing is the shear of the atmosphere. Anytime you have wind at one location different than the wind at another location. It's like putting a pencil between your hands and spinning it. Your hands are not rotating, but the pencil inside of them, or in between your hands, starts to turn. So that's...
By the way, that's an excellent description of what shear is, right? I mean, we'll think of it as the change in velocity with distance, right? A velocity gradient. But you're right. Winds moving at different velocities as you change your position, right? That's exactly correct.
And ultimately, that leads to that term that you use, this vorticity, or a measure of rotation. And vorticity can be small, or as you tighten it up and spin something around, it gets noticeable to the naked eye.
Right.
So you kind of look up at the storm, and you can see indications that the storm itself has got rotation.
Okay.
The storm might be 8 miles across, and you can see signs that there's rotation, or there might be...
He melts. Feel that Hebrew groove all the way from the tips of your peos down to the soles of your tevas. Tune in to Kosher Noise Monday nights from 7 to 8 p.m. with your host, DJ Melts.
Welcome back to Inside the Black Box, where we're blathering on about whether or not academics are utterly out of touch with the real world. And I wanted to finish what I was talking about with the science in the news. Basically, they've seen a little blip on one of the results that may or may not be related to the God particle. It certainly is consistent with the way the Higgs boson should show up in these various collision experiments, but they've only got a statistical significance to about 1 part in 1,000, right? And they want to go to 1 part in 3.5 million, something like that, which sounds to me about, 5 sigma out, something like that?
I have no idea what you just said.
Okay, well, in any case,
you're collapsing into
they don't have enough statistical significance. I am. So, and the point is, they've got some new data. They're analyzing this. This may be available for an early July conference on this, so stay tuned. And it's important not because it's like, oh, this proves God exists. It's the God's part. No, it sort of, what's the word we were using before? It provides...
Consilience
in the view of the standard model. That's what it does. So, I mean, it's sort of converging to a very reasonable, verified solution.
I always thought of it as that's the piece that fits the empty space in the jigsaw puzzle.
Yeah, that's kind of what
it is. We got to find that. We know what it looks like. We got a clear idea of what the color of it's going to be because we want to see the image finished. But we don't have it. We can't see it. So you got to dig in the couch.
Right, but they're pretty darn sure they need that one piece to finish.
Because they figured everything else out, right?
Yeah. No, that's exactly it. And physicists have never liked this. In fact, a lot of times it...
I quote a professional thinker?
Yeah.
Who cares what physicists don't like?
That's what Trent said during the break.
he has a degree in discrete mathematics. He should know.
What does that make
minus him? One course. How many credits? 5 or 3. He doesn't even know.
He doesn't even know. He's making too much money working in the internet security field. I can't find my notes on which physicist first coined that.
I'm going to give you a little extra time. Do you know, I think it's a tradition at Georgia Tech for people to get a job their last semester
and never finish,
not be able to get the last class and for it never to matter. That they just kind of, 10 years later, they're like, oh, you know what? My credits are starting to disappear. Should I?
Yeah, after 10 years, there's like a statute of limitations.
Yeah, so fields that don't require a master's degree or PhD for people to take you seriously, you can get the education and then just kind of step out and start working and get your real world education outside the university.
Okay, so let's, because I can't find the guy who coined that phrase.
Can we forget about the God
particle? Let's talk about the real world.
I don't believe the God particle exists. I'm not sure there's any proof that it exists, and I don't see why it matters.
Well, the point I wanted to make is that people overblow these things with too much hyperbole. They call it the God particle. Same thing with nanotechnology. We've talked about that before. Nanotechnology is just a unit change. It's the same physics, chemistry, and material science we've done for the last 100 years. We just crossed the 100-nanometer barrier.
I thought it was tiny robots.
No, that's what I'm saying. Then people went crazy. God particle, the gray goo.
Tiny robots.
And they started writing crazy things about science fiction and things like that.
It's the plague again.
But we've been doing nanotechnology for a long time, certainly in the microelectronics field where they make small chips and things
What's after nanotechnology? If it gets smaller, what's the next bar?
Let's see, nanometer, what is it, picometer?
So pico technology? That sounds awesome.
And if you look up pico technology, you will find it. Pico technology it's not really feasible because the way we manipulate matter is sort of at the nanometer level. So beyond Pico technology, we're talking about today's article, the Higgs boson. That's Pico technology.
So what if we use nanotechnology to build tiny mechanics who can then do the Pico technology?
You're hurting my brain now. What if we do that? Well, I mean, in a sense, that's what we do. We do take nanometer-scaled atoms and whale them on each other.
And then the Pico technology can develop.
And then we break them into smaller particles.
Small nanotechnologies to then build even smaller technologies. What's
okay.
after Pico?
I'm going to quote Feynman here, where he implemented the entire fury about nanotechnology when he said there's always room at the bottom. And that speaks to your intellectual capability on the radio. There's always room at the bottom. But if you do see Pico technology, it usually refers to very fast time processes, picoseconds.
Got it.
I thought that was a crazy thing happening. And I will say this, my good friend K.E. Castellan, who runs the Facebook page for Nerd Fun Atlanta, sent me a great photo that I posted on my Facebook page. It was of a young girl supposedly protesting out CERN. Maybe this has to do with their recent discovery. This was back in December where they first got the data of the Higgs boson, that said if God had meant for particles to collide, he would have sped them up in heaven. Or if Jesus meant for particles to collide, he would have sped them up in heaven. Yeah, I want to laugh at that one, too. I just, really? Particle accelerators are that controversial, right?
Yeah.
Is that really a moral judgment part? I mean, you know, that's what I'm saying. I understand why people have issues with abortion and with other things like that, right? There are moral involvements in there. That's an
Peter,
issue.
Are you old enough to remember the split? I mean, I'm not, and I don't. I'm being serious. Was there a split when it started to seem like scientists were undermining social values? I mean, did that happen?
I'm not old enough to remember it, but actually Chris Mooney does talk a little bit about, he does allude to that in his book, and he's written other books, The Republican War on Science. And really, it happened not because there was too little information about science, but because there was so much information. And that he actually talks about in his latest book. So,
Meaning there was some information overload, the public.
Yeah, there was too much information.
Sort out what they were being told.
And because there was too much information, and now we have it all on the web, it's very difficult to validate the information, right? And speaking of validating the information, that actually speaks to some of the points about being out in the real world. Let's see. Have you got John's latest email from us?
I think that might be
so
it.
So, John, we are building an entire program about you. That's how
about
grateful
your correspondence.
We are. About your correspondence. About the points that you're making, actually. All right, did you put this? Oh, no, that's mine. Okay. Did you put this out of order? You put this out of order. Oh, no.
Just to make it easy on you.
Where's the latest points?
You sort it out. I'm going to talk real quick.
All right, you talk. You never talk real quick. Aren't you talking quickly? You're confusing your adjectives and adverbs. Aren't you a librarian?
Nice. I like
a
where
you're going
with this.
A warrior king at the
But you're distracting yourself.
I'm turning on you like a pack of dingoes.
There was a show a little while ago where I guess I was just in a mood, and so I went after Pete, and I think he's been trying to get me back ever since. So the idea that I think if you have a liberal and a conservative that you could say that there are some essential natures to these two people that blossom into a bunch of
political views, social
views,
social
all views,
kinds
cultural
of views,
right,
yeah,
right.
Cultural
but
views.
But you know, a liberal and a conservative. Maybe if we could just do the split that a liberal is someone who thinks that things should be changed immediately, and a conservative is someone who thinks that things are pretty good the way they are and just need to be improved. Does that sound?
Do they think there needs? Some of them don't think it needs to be improved. Some of them do.
No, I don't. I don't think there are any conservatives who think that everything is fine exactly
oh, okay.
how it is. But I think that the system operates. We just need the system to operate better.
Oh, okay.
While there are some people who feel that the system operates poorly and needs to stop doing what it does, and that's where you can look at someone who says, we have to. We have to regulate, we have to oversee, we have to transform or disable large systems like capitalism or even religion, right? Which sounds like a liberal person
yeah.
versus conservatives who say that we need to support all of our changes, all of our exploration with what has come before,
mm-hmm.
right? I just heard that in J.F. Buckley's voice in my head. So, what's in my head? Yeah, Buckley.
Okay, J.F. Buckley as opposed to William. Oh, is J.F. Buckley his son? Who's J.F. Buckley? Isn't it William F. Buckley?
Yeah, it is William F. Buckley. I don't know why I had John F. Buckley.
Obviously, you've got some weird version
of
Buckley in your
head.
You know what?
I had Kennedy and Buckley in some sort of horrible misrepresentation of, like, nanotechnology-influenced Call of the Cthulhu sort of horror monster thing in my head.
And basically, we are confirming every one of John's points that liberal, crazy academics just ramble on and won't focus.
I'm just trying to fill time on the radio while you sort out the emails.
Okay, I can't even find the email. But the point is, let me clarify a few things about Chris Mooney's book. Number one, I think I tried to make this point to John, and that is that there are advantages to both these personality types. And one of the disadvantages to the more liberal personality type is that it... we like to think about everything for an infinite amount of time, right? And you just can't do that. Sometimes you have to make a decision. And, for example, engineers, which I am, and I'm probably one of the more liberal engineers, but engineers, compared to scientists, are much more conservative because they eventually have to say, we can't sit around thinking about the theoretical ramifications of the Higgs boson. We have to design the bridge and put a decision down on a blueprint. So they actually tend to be more conservative when they do that. And I do want to apologize. We may have given John and some of our other listeners the impression that the conservative personality type does not take risks. That's incorrect. They are less likely to risk changing their fundamental views. But in terms of risk, I think John makes a very good point in one of his first emails that I don't know, and I tried to look for data to suggest, what do you guys think? Entrepreneurs, are they more conservative types or liberal types in their personality? Forget about their politics, just their personality. What do you guys think?
I would say that entrepreneurship does not have a particular...
Yeah, I would tend to think it's reasonably... Do you think it's balanced? I mean...
I think there's a lot of both. I mean...
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of entrepreneurs and, like, venture capitalists are in New York and San Francisco, and, I mean, there's all kinds of people in both those places.
Yeah.
But, I mean, also a lot of the stuff is when you say they're less likely to, like, take a risk they think will change the fundamental or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a lot of the times, some reasons the entrepreneurs work is because they don't think they're taking a risk. Like, they know it's going to happen. It's not a risk to them, but everyone on the outside is like, that's really risky. So, I mean, just because they don't consider it a risk just because everyone else considers it risky doesn't mean they think it's that way.
Mm. But, I mean, I would argue that being an entrepreneur is a big risk. So, yeah, so we didn't mean to imply that they don't take risks. In fact, I would think to some degree you're probably a little more heavily weighted on the conservative personality type who like to do their own kind of thing, particularly in, you know, financial, corporate, economic type entrepreneurship. Not necessarily, you know, what a lot of liberals will do is they'll do the same entrepreneurship in a charity-driven way.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Yeah. Like, if you came up with a business and you were providing clean water,
that's community entrepreneurship.
A third world country. Yeah. Most people would think, oh, look, a liberal, you know. But it's not a liberal who is creating a business. It's maybe a liberal who says we should provide clean water to third world countries.
Yeah.
Maybe. And you know, that's just doing the whole, oh, hippie environment kind of thing. But again, I think as soon as you start talking about liberal and conservative, you know, you're trying to identify them by cultural values, political values, social values that aren't liberal or conservative. Liberal or conservative is a mentality.
Yeah, change
and
versus not change.
Choices are made. Yeah. Choices are made of what you think is...
Yeah,
it should happen.
Yeah, and if someone were, say, a conservative entrepreneur, there's no doubt they would change their strategy or approach in marketing or manufacturing to suit
to
what's happening.
To improve it, to make things
absolutely
work.
Absolutely. Yeah, so if we gave the impression that those kinds of risks are not taken by conservative personality types, that is absolutely wrong. That's not what Chris Mooney's book says, and that is my fault for not communicating that correctly. But I think it's clinging to... beliefs.
Climate change seems to be the hook that this all got hung on.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
And so climate change is a concept that everybody leaves behind whether or not the climate has changed as soon as you get into what you're supposed to do because of that climate change.
Right.
And you have folks who say, well, we should stop driving cars. And then you have folks who say the only people who don't want to stop driving cars
are these hippie, liberal, crazy
people. Soft-minded folks who just want to take away other people's benefits.
Yeah. And I do drive a car, and I do enjoy driving a car. And
I hate driving a car. Do you know my unicorn got loose? The thing about climate change is that it became a way to discredit politicians. And I think that it just blew up at that point and turned into a liberal versus conservative question. And I think that that's a mistake.
Yeah.
To start thinking of climate change. You know, the emails, the propaganda machine that was revealed by the leaked emails.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Some people, when that happened, their thought was, yes, scientists have to present their research in a way that gets support.
We want to get more funding. Absolutely.
Yeah. And some people said, aha, see, they're just trying to make money for themselves and also probably make people feel bad.
Yeah, and this is the logic that John actually presents very succinctly in his last email that, you know, if you want to get more funding, and we do, because that's how we survive. And in that respect, being an academic is very entrepreneurial, right? You survive by getting other people to pay for research. More and more, it's not the federal government that does that. Right. We wish it was. Right. I think there's a very small percentage of our total budget that goes to that research.
It's a lot of businesses.
Yeah. So now you have to go to the Department of Defense. You have to go to businesses to do that very thing. And it is John's assertion that because of that motivation, and he's absolutely right, because of that motivation, we want to get more funding. We will make our results and couch them in a way such that we can get more funding. To some degree, that does happen. There's no doubt about it. And some people abuse that. They really do abuse that.
By couching your results, you know, that goes from everywhere from here's a narrative that makes you understand the data all the way down to let's just lie, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think that a lot of people assume that let's just lie is the common way.
Yes, yeah. And I'm interested.
And I don't think that's
send
true,
us an email
but that seems
comments
to be...
at Inside the Black Box if you have that view and share with us why you have that view. I'm very interested to hear that.
Yeah, if you think that scientists will lie, blatantly lie in such a way as to...
And some do.
Yeah, to make them bad people. If you think they'll do that to continue research...
Well, the British physician who came up with the whole autism link to vaccinations.
Yeah, that's
did
a scientist.
Just that. Yeah,
that's a scientist.
Yeah.
I'm talking about, I mean, if you think that the
scientific
is going to have a conspiracy of...
Right. And here's why I don't think it's systematic. You can always interpret the theory like they're doing right now with Higgs boson. They're trying to understand how Higgs bosons... undergo this mechanism and decay and change. There's even a funnier named boson that they actually transition to.
What was the funnier name?
I forget. It's in my notes somewhere, but I'm exhausted beyond all capacity for thought, so I'm not going to look for it in my
notes. Is it because of these gray walls?
No, it is in the New York Times article. If you read the Science Times, you can find out about that. And frankly, if you just look up on Wikipedia the Higgs boson, it will describe that mechanism.
Would you please not do that?
Why?
Just don't. I mean... It's just, there are so many better ways of finding more out about topics besides Wikipedia.
And those would be?
Encyclopedia Britannica would be a great place to start for someone who wanted to learn more about anything.
And is that because Encyclopedia Britannica is in the library where you work?
There are many libraries that have Encyclopedia Britannica in it. I'm just saying, Wikipedia is a football, right? Any page that is under some kind of controversy, it goes down to the 10-yard line and it goes back to the other 10-yard line, back and forth and back and forth.
Actually, I don't think there's a lot of controversy in the Higgs boson page. I looked at it.
I bet you that if you went and looked at the edit history, you'd find a bunch of people who had a lot to say. And in fact, I'm going to do that when we get off the air.
You do that, monkey boy. All right, so the point is, what was the point? We've lost our train of thought now.
It's a little hot in here.
Basically that...
the steam's coming off your head.
Yeah, so we'd like to hear from you if you actually believe that. I mean, that is a view that I think John has. And he shared with us his logic on that you know, it's sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy that you want to do that. And granted, with the interpretation, you can always make a different interpretation. But in the end, you have to take the actual data. And that needs to be reproduced. That needs to be published. And someone, if they disagree with it, that's where it gets thrown out. So fundamental data, no, that's where I disagree. You can't. You can push that for so long. And in the case of this autism linked to vaccinations, it was, you know, many, many years. But eventually, someone's going to disprove that, and you will be utterly discredited.
This is what I've been talking about a lot. Yeah. Whenever we're together on the radio, the narrative of what you're doing is incredibly important, the way that it's fashioned. I think that a lot of people have responded to climate change narratives poorly because they're often aggressive. They're often created by people who have a personal stake. And by that, I mean folks who feel that once they find out what's going on in climate change, that it proves their whole sense of the world, and they jump ahead into, you know, here's what's happening, here's the story. And John, I mean, he essentially sent us a story in that email, the way he explained, this is what people need to do to be able to continue their research, and this is what happens if they don't find a problem, right? And that's a story not in the sense of, oh, you're telling a story, it's not true, but that's a story in the sense of that's a narrative of how things work. And so the narratives that are presented are as important or possibly more important than the research, the data, and the process behind the results.
Yeah, and scientists don't realize that.
Mostly.
I was going to say, I'd always wondered, or I never understood why everything was always like polarized and like in conservative and liberal like view. And then it was kind of pigeonholed as like, oh, well, that's kind of liberal, so let's just like push it all the way liberal. And I mean, you're kind of arguing again, like for the academic process, like you want to conserve the academic process and keep it the same. So I mean, why does that, like, why are you like automatically just all liberal when you're already trying to conserve the process? And like, that's the same thing you're saying like a conservative would do.
Okay.
Nicely like, done. I like how you just blew everything up.
Excellent point. And well, I mean, I think we're inherently liberal because most researchers are doing research because they think the status quo is not perfect and they think they have a way to improve it. So we're inherently going to be liberal on that. And you're right. Anyone that wants to keep the current academic process because they're wedded to that and they have a conservative view of that, and there are plenty of what you would think of as liberal people when it comes to science who love that process, that's bad. I think that's bad. I think there are big flaws in this whole process. And believe it or not, there's less and less government funding. So a lot of people are being very entrepreneurial. They're going to companies, things like that. I just got, I don't know, the seventh proposal in a row on our improvisational innovation research technique.
How's that working? What do people say when you do that?
They what are you, goofy? I think is the most common thing we get back from these.
That's one of my favorite phrases.
So, in fact, the only way Lou and I, who talked about this a few months ago, are going to get this funded is we're going to go directly to companies. But I will say this, and let me use an example of my colleague, Cliff Henderson. We were in a meeting the other day, and in fact, at 2 o'clock today, I've got a conference call with the corporate sponsor, a big semiconductor maker. And our results are saying that as we take this new self-assembly technique to make smaller and smaller features on a chip, there are some problems developing with it. And, you know, we're just going to give them what we have because if we say it's this versus that, eventually, if we twisted something, it's going to come out. There are lots of research groups working on this. There are lots of other folks doing that, but we don't own a company that's you know, using this particular technology. We're not invested in this company. Yeah, it might mean an extra year of funding or something like that, but that's not that much money. It's eventually going to peter out if what we're finding is true or not. I mean, we're continuing to research this sort of stuff. But then we'll simply go off in a different direction and take a different technology and work on that. So you simply have to adapt and change to do that. But you're right. The problem comes when individual academics are so invested in a company that uses that
personally.
In effect, that's why we all fill out a conflict of interest statement every year. And that's why physicians who publish in journals say, look, I did this study and it was a study on drug X. And by the way, one of the sponsors of the study who paid for this and my salary and my, you know, grad students and stuff was the manufacturer of drug X. That's got to be out there. So and you'd be amazed in medical journals how many people are connected to that. At least they have to report it. Mm-hmm. So that's a good thing. That's the minimum requirement that they do that. So Yeah, I think the biggest collusion on that sort of stuff is when direct money is to be made, not so much when, as John points out, oh, we could tax this CO2 stuff if only the scientists could do that stuff. I don't think any scientist is making a lot of money on global warming. I really don't. There are other issues where there is conflict of interest and the results come out in that direction. But that's usually when it's corporate-sponsored research, not the other way around. Because think about it. At one point, somebody did research on the ozone hole and CO2 and greenhouse gases before anyone had an idea that that existed. So no one really pushed it in that direction.
I was in grade school, like an eighth grader, explaining the science of ozone. You know, he acted it out and everything. He said, you know, when there's an oxygen molecule and
O3.
And they get really excited and they jump on each other or something like that. You know, it was, you know, that stuff was out there and it was understandable.
Yeah.
You know, very early on. And I think that it's been confused by a very cynical narrative.
Yeah.
Which is not liberal or conservative. It's just a cynical narrative. Cynical narrative that the people in power want particular answers and the people who are not in power will provide those answers.
Yeah, I think the people in power aren't that smart. That's what I think. The
people in power are quite dumb except when they're not.
Yeah. Thanks for shedding that insight.
Just wanted to make that clear.
But in answer to Trent's question, we didn't used to be this polarized. This whole idea of left and right and fighting against each other is a relatively new concept. And it's only come to a head in maybe the last couple decades because of this explosion of information. But one thing Chris does is he starts with a narrative to explain this whole thing. And he starts during the French Revolution when the first critical thinkers that pointed out left and right views when it came to putting together the French Constitution sort of coined those two extremes. So that's a relatively new thing. And this I will say about global warming and climate change. And if you listen to our show last year with Judy Curry, the school chair from the Georgia Tech Earth and Atmospheric Sciences Department, she actually gave a relatively conservative view on this, that there is so much uncertainty, it's not even funny. When Al Gore shows the hockey stick graph, I love the hockey stick graph, and, you know, usually when you get something that, you know, is relatively flat and then turns up at a rapid rate, like the edge of a hockey stick, the blade of a hockey stick, for those of you that live in Georgia have never played hockey, that is something significant. And what that is that's the CO2 amount. And we can do mass balances and calculations and, in fact, point out that it is very, very likely that all that CO2 increase is due to human output of CO2. But we can't say much more than that definitively because it's so complicated. And if you listen to Sally Ng's discussion of the effect of aerosols, that was a few weeks ago, and of course I had technical difficulties, and that is not archived, so she's going to kill me for that one. But it was a great show that pointed out greenhouse gases tend to heat the Earth. Water is a greenhouse gas, by the way, so it's very complicated. And then aerosols can't either heat or cool, and there's this complex interplay of that. And what John may have pointed out, I think in one of his emails, the Earth goes through cycles as well. So there's the natural cycle. Then there's these man-made greenhouse gases, man-made aerosols. Aerosols might be masking the amount of global warming. These observations that we're melting ice sheets. You can't really argue with that because it's quite significant. And then it works with the way we're leaching minerals out of the land, they're going into the freshwater streams, we're overfishing parts of the coast. It's a much more complicated problem than just CO2 and some greenhouse gases and even aerosols.
Can I throw my favorite in?
Yeah.
The algae explosions.
Yeah, that's all related to it. Right.
I love those.
Both green and red algae. It's very complicated.
The ice is thinning out a little bit in patches, and so the algae below those thinned out patches is getting a lot more sunlight, and it's just going crazy. Yeah. And it's going to star in the next Guillermo del Toro movie, I'm sure. Okay. As the monster.
Right. And the issue is not, do we have a little global warming? The issue is, will that global warming be part of other variable changes that will lead to an utter destabilization of the climate? It's much more complicated than just global warming. But the point is, I think we should be conservative and cut down on a lot of humans' impact on the environment, not just emissions from cars and things like that, but overfish. We've overfished coasts of various continents.
You filthy liberal.
Yeah, I guess.
Wanting to be conservative about The human effect on... Okay, wait, yeah. That doesn't work.
So I cannot debate intelligently the effect of climate change because it's just too complicated. And that is a point that Judy Curry made.
Yeah.
She suggested more logical steps in doing that. So so we will continue this. All right, we're almost to the end here.
Trent's got some stuff going on. Do you want to give us a count? Do we need
keep
to...
talking.
Got it.
All right, so are we killing airtime because we can't get a hold of our chief engineer to switch things over? So your thoughts on that?
I think that the, conflicting narratives.
Students excited about it, but then, and I'm going to steal this because this is so good, create a doorway to the scientific method by basically using this very complex meteorological phenomenon and the framework behind it, supercells, vorticity, the formation of tornadoes, and getting people excited about it from the standpoint of both understanding and predicting, because that really is sort of the valuable thing to society in these things, and getting people all excited about it, but then making it real by have them actually see this thing in all its glory.
Yep.
And along the way,
that's
they learn
a nice summary.
Yeah, and they learn all sorts of interesting things. Like we aren't the only folks with tornadoes. We have sort of have this tornado alley, and what was it? If we paved over the Gulf, we could severely limit the number of tornadoes.
Yeah, the electricity.
Talk about climate change. That would definitely be a climate change.
Yeah, I don't think you want to mention. There are probably people in the federal government who would consider paving over the Gulf just to eliminate, say, liability laws.
It would make it easier to put the oil derricks there, I'm sure.
Yeah, it might.
Yeah, and then
it might.
Nationwide drought every year, it would be right. Bad too. So
wow. So, and then, of course, hopefully where you guys are going with this is more data, which, as Trent pointed out, is kind of the opposite of what a lot of other folks, the biological folks, probably have more data than they know what to do with. Certainly my colleagues in bioengineering do as well. But as we get that, hopefully we will improve this ability to predict. And that's got to impact everybody's life, because if you've ever lived in the Midwest like we have, it's you get these things all the time.
Yeah, right? Absolutely.
And I guess it's always important to keep sort of advancing the science, because as you mentioned, in the 1990s, when these Doppler radars, this NEXRAD radar, started coming out, you observed lots of this rotation that may or may not have actually been the thing that produces these tornadoes.
Correct.
Wow. So is there...
Yeah, our eyes opened up to more and more complexity.
Okay.
Pretty cool.
Is there anything else we need to mention?
Well, our website...
Okay.
Checking us out at weather.cod.edu.
Okay, and there's actually a link to you on the faculty on our website, insidetheblackbox.org, where
Perfect.
They can actually find that website. So
yeah, we have data that people can use just for looking about the weather, more than just the chasing. We do a big website.
So oh, wow, because we do a lot of, we like to teach a lot of stuff on statistical analysis. I will check it out and see if that would be sort of a neat hands-on thing that we could have our students analyze.
Excellent.
All right. So, Paul, thank you so much for being on the program.
My pleasure.
And if any of our listeners have a question or comment or a suggestion for a future program here on Inside the Black Box, by all means, send us an email at comments@insidetheblackbox.org. Our chief engineer is Trent Altman. Our theme music is performed and composed by Bill and Mary Hunt. And we are a production of the WREK Studios here on the campus of the Georgia Institute of Technology. Please join us next week for Inside the Black Box, Science Only Funnier.